Thanks, guys. So foreign aid is generally understood as money that is given from wealthier nations to the poor to try and help lift them out of poverty. And for this reason, it is often attacked by right-wing governments, such as the Trump administration, who say it's an unnecessary handout of money that could much better be spent domestically. But this is actually not a view shared by most of the Western ruling class, who actually see and use foreign aid as a political and economic tool to advance their interests internationally. These interests can be about opening up new markets for corporations from the donor countries, placing political conditions on the recipient countries, or expanding imperialist influence into geopolitically strategic regions. So while there should definitely be a responsibility for wealthy nations to assist the poor, and the right-wing administration's moves to cut aid budgets should be called out for the racism that kind of guides this decision, foreign aid is not a real solution in its current form to global poverty. So I want to just start with a brief overview of what foreign aid distribution kind of looks like today. So the five poorest countries in the world, as measured by GDP per capita, are the Democratic Republic of Congo, Mozambique, Uganda, Tajikistan, and Haiti. None of these countries are actually in the top 10 recipients of foreign aid from from the world's biggest donors, and I think this alone should raise some alarm bells. The five biggest donor countries are China, the US, Germany, the UK, and Japan, and their aid falls into three formal categories. First, there's development, which is supposedly about long-term economic growth. The second is humanitarian, which is to deal with short-term crises like environmental disasters, and finally, military spending. So to take a look at the total US aid budget, which is the world's biggest donor, development covers 42% of aid, humanitarian is 14%, and then 33% is spent on military spending. But these percentages actually shift when you just look at the top 10 recipients of American foreign aid. And just quickly, they are Israel, Egypt, Jordan, Afghanistan, Kenya, Tanzania, Uganda, Zambia, Nigeria, and Iraq. So military aid for these countries is actually almost 60% of the total. So the countries receiving the most aid are largely getting military assistance. In the United Kingdom, £14.1 billion is spent on foreign aid, with Pakistan, Nigeria, Ethiopia, Afghanistan and Syria as the biggest recipients. £700 million of this goes towards military spending, though that's a figure that shifts quite a bit year on year. A few years ago, it was much larger. Statistics on Chinese foreign aid are less clear, but it appears that the top recipients are largely targets of the Belt and Road Initiative. Actually, half of all spending went to servicing infrastructure development for the initiative over the past year. And another important category to consider when looking at foreign aid is tied aid. So tied aid is aid dependent on the recipient countries purchasing commodities and services from the donor countries. So while the OECD has moved to reduce the formal amount of tied aid over the past decade, formally reduce, in practice over half of all aid contracts continue to go to companies based in the donor countries. Tied aid also applies to military spending. Most of the American military aid budget is actually used for the recipient country to purchase weapons from American manufacturers and services like military training from the American military itself. So from this basic overview, I think you can start to get the idea that there is a lot more to foreign aid than altruism. So as we've already seen, the countries that are in the most need are actually getting very little, and aid budgets are minuscule when compared to domestic spending on military budgets. So America spends almost $700 billion annually on their military, compared to $32 billion on aid. In 1970, the G8 countries, then G7, committed each nation to spending 0.7% of their total budgets on foreign aid. But so far, Britain is the only one to have reached this target. It only did so in 2015, and it's facing serious oppositions from sections of Parliament to maintaining it, especially now that Boris Johnson is the leader. The Australian government also spends less than 0.2% of its total budget expenditure on aid annually. But in saying this, I think simply increasing foreign aid budgets can't escape the fact that it's vested interests that guide aid spending, and this is often to the detriment of the recipient populations. So the first thing I want to talk about in a bit of detail is how foreign aid is used by governments quite directly as a tool to realise their imperialist ambitions abroad. So we can trace this right back to 1948 when the American government launched the Marshall Plan, which was $12 billion of economic assistance, $100 billion in today's money, to rebuild Europe, which had been devastated economically, politically, socially by World War II. This was not philanthropic aid. It was designed to reconstruct an entire international political and economic system under the hegemony of the US, the most powerful state coming out of that war. Marshall Aid opened up new markets for American corporations. A full $2 billion of it went to purchasing American oil. It also aimed to stabilise European capitalism after the discrediting Great Depression and then global war, the radicalisation of the resistance movements, especially in the South, and it ensured that the kind of imperialist threats of Germany and Japan could not remilitarise. One of the main political conditions attached to receiving this aid was to demand conservative rule in all the countries that received it. So communists and other resistance leaders had to be kicked out of governments in France and Italy, and then in order to keep receiving aid, they had to be maintained in isolation. So this carried over into the Cold War, where foreign aid was targeted towards countries that the US feared might otherwise fall under the influence of the Soviet Union, starting with Greece and Turkey, which both had very large communist movements, and then extending to other dictatorial regimes like that in Vietnam and Iran. And over the last 20 years, we can see quite a direct correlation between the recipients of Western aid and the current motivations of Western imperialism. So in 2006, the then US Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice said, "It is impossible to draw neat, clear lines between our security interests, our development efforts, and our democratic ideals." This was in the context of the War on Terror and the redistribution of American foreign aid to represent George Bush's coalition of the willing. So that was countries that signed up alongside the US to plunder and bomb the Middle East. Aid was increased to countries near the front lines of war, either to pacify them or encourage them to join the war effort. So this was Turkey, Jordan, Bahrain, Oman, and Pakistan. But it was also given to a number of European nations, especially Central and Eastern European nations, who provided diplomatic support for Bush and the war in the UN. So tellingly, when Slovenia announced they were not in fact joining the coalition, the $4.5 million in military aid that had been designated to them was then revoked. Today, Iraq and Afghanistan, the main targets of Western domination in the War on Terror, are both listed in the top 10 recipients of American aid at $3.7 billion and $5.7 billion respectively. The Middle East, with its oil supplies and very important trade routes, continues to be of strategic importance for the United States, and aid is used to cultivate relationships with local players. Egypt and Jordan both receive over $1 billion of aid assistance annually. But the biggest cumulative recipient of American foreign aid since World War II is Israel. This is not because Israel is the neediest or poorest country in the world, far from it. It's because Israel has been the closest and most stable ally of the US in the Middle East for decades. Israel's share of foreign aid had actually slipped relative to other countries. Until in 2016, the Obama administration signed a $38 billion security assistance deal with them to be dispersed over a decade starting from this year. So now, as of 2019, Israel is again the largest recipient of American foreign aid, and almost every single cent of it is spent on the military. Within 5 years, 100% of these military contracts will go to American weapons manufacturers like Lockheed Martin. When Theresa May visited Africa in September 2018, she announced that in the post-Brexit world, Britain's aid would be used to promote British trade and political interests. So this was more a confirmation of what was already happening than a break. In 2018, the countries already receiving the lion's share of British foreign aid were either important markets like Nigeria, or tied to geopolitical interests such as Pakistan, Afghanistan and Syria. I just want to explain a bit how Australia fits into this whole picture as well. So Australian foreign aid is tied to the same imperialist logic. As a kind of mid-level imperialist power, Australia has always seen the Asia-Pacific as its local playground. There's a whole history of invasion and occupation of Southwest Pacific countries, which is beyond the scope of this talk, and the aid budget is still very largely tied to these ambitions. So that in addition to the general orientation of the Western Imperialist Alliance. So the Pacific receives the largest quantity of Australian foreign aid, which is currently $1.3 billion, which is granted to secure Australian-imposed stability in the region. This is squarely down to the Australian ruling class's fear of a threat from the north in the context of rising imperialist tensions between the US and China and also growing Chinese influence in this part of the world. So in November 2018, Scott Morrison announced that it was time for Australia to step up in the Southwest Pacific region, claiming that this is our patch, this is our part of the world. Morrison announced a new aid package for Pacific Islander countries, including, there's quite a lot in it, but it includes $1 billion to for finance assistance to help Australian businesses compete in the region, and also supplying 19 new naval patrol boats to several Pacific countries. This is in the context of the Pacific Islander Forum that took place last week, where what people were desperately asking for was real action on climate change as their islands start to sink, which Scott Morrison flatly refused. So Papua New Guinea is the single biggest recipient of Australian foreign aid. PNG was an Australian colony until 1975, and since formal independence was granted, the Australian government has held very tight reins over its government and economy. Today, Australian aid makes up a whole 8% of PNG's total budget. That's money which has bought an enormous amount of influence. So in 2004, the two countries signed a new bilateral trade agreement, which sets the scene for the relationship that exists between the two today. So several dozen senior Australian officials took up management positions in the PNG public service, mainly in areas relating to governance and finance. More than 200 Australian police took control of the PNG police force, and the number of Australian military officials guiding the PNG army also increased. This intervention remains in place today, over a decade later, and it's Australian officials who largely determine how other aid money is spent and which companies will be contracted. In a slightly other note, aid money is also being used to pressure the PNG government to allow the concentration camps housing refugees seeking asylum in Australia to be established and maintained on Manus Island, which PNG holds sovereignty over. When the Australian aid budget was cut by one-fifth in 2015, PNG was exempt from this, which was at the time widely seen as a payoff for maintaining the camps. Also, at the end of 2012, under the previous Gillard government, Australia itself became the third biggest recipient of Australian foreign aid when $375 million of the aid budget was reallocated to running the onshore detention centres housing refugees. So this money was contracted to Serco, a multinational corporation responsible for running prisons and immigration centres in a number of countries. Okay, so I want to move on to talking a bit about how foreign aid often maintains poverty in some of the poorest countries rather than eradicating it. So Western leaders frequently square the blame of poverty on the suffering countries themselves. They speak as if it's written into their DNA to be poor economic managers or generally unproductive communities. It's actually the long and sordid history of colonialism and imperialism that has left much of the global south in abject poverty today. So sub-Saharan Africa is the poorest and most heavily aid-dependent region in the world, and the West is squarely to blame for this, dating back to the slave trade and colonial invasion, which was essential to the whole formation of global capitalism. between 9 and 13 million slaves were sold across the Atlantic up until 1870, and the entire population of sub-Saharan Africa did not grow between 1750 and 1850, which devastated any potential for economic growth. The European powers carved up the continent and much of Asia and Latin America between themselves, imposing brutal colonial rule and plundering the lands of their resources. Liberation movements of the mid-20th century fought to free themselves from this domination, but then often out of them, regimes of local elites were established, which had often been trained by the West, and many countries remained dominated by multinationals and big banks. Governments that were deemed too unfavourable to Western interests faced armed interventions which tore states apart, which explains a lot of the conflict that we still see there today, and stoked local ethnic conflict and imposed dictators. Today, multinationals and local capital continue to plunder the Third World, robbing the people there of the opportunity to exercise any kind of genuine democratic will. And the conditionalities that are attached to aid are a really central part of this. So even where aid is not directly tied to imperialist intervention, it still comes with political and economic strings attached, designed to favour the donor countries rather than free the poor from economic misery. So an entire multinational industry has developed around foreign aid. It involves consultants, expensive advertising and lucrative contracts. Less than 7% of aid money actually lands in the hands of governments of the recipient countries, let alone in the hands of the populations that desperately need it. In 2005, the World Bank admitted that $20 billion out of a total $50 billion of the global aid budget was spent on consultants. In 1996 to the year 2000, money deposited to a trust fund that was designed to try and finance debt reduction by the IMF was actually less than the money spent on the wages of the department's 2,300 employees. And the aid agencies who operate in recipient countries, which are often NGOs, wield an enormous amount of power over the local communities whose entire well-being is often dependent on the benevolence of the companies. And I don't have time to give a long explanation of NGOs, but I think it's no surprise that this power is often used in really the most horrific ways, as with the recent revelations of rampant sexual abuse carried out by Oxfam workers, as these organisations actually stand formally above the law in both the countries they're operating in and in their home countries. So I want to explain tied aid a little bit more, which I mentioned earlier. So aid that has to be contracted to corporations from donor countries. So the Jubilee Debt Campaign Group, which is based in the UK, found in 2012 that a whole 92% of British aid contracts signed over the previous 18 months had gone to British corporations. One really high-profile example of this was the Bywater debacle in Tanzania. So this was in 2003. The British company Bywater was awarded the contract to run the water and sewerage supply in Dar es Salaam. This was after privatisation of the state-run service had been deemed a requirement for further debt relief from the IMF and the World Bank. And was also really heavily pushed by the British government, which gave £10 million to the project. So it quickly turned into a disaster. The scheme produced less revenue than the previous state-owned service. Prices soared for the local population, and supply was barely increased. So the company was kicked out of Tanzania in 2005, but then proceeded to take the impoverished country to court. So tied aid can also hamper local economic development by driving out local producers as the market becomes flooded by imported goods from the donor country. So countries become even more economically dependent on the world's major powers and more sensitive to shifts in the global market. Religious organisations also tie aid in another way. They administer services, often on the condition that their moral code is strictly imposed on recipient communities. All right, I'm going to move on to talking about multilateral aid. So this is aid which is mediated through international financial institutions like the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, and the World Bank. So these were both also founded after World War II to facilitate Western economic investment overseas and to ensure imperialist dominance of the world's most powerful states, chiefly the US. Over the past 40 years, they have trapped much of the third world in a prison of monumental debt, which can only be serviced by more lending that has harsh neoliberal conditions attached to it. So while these organisations often pitch themselves as independent lenders, I think they're much better understood as subsidiary institutions of the US government, and they're actually funded by different countries' aid budgets. So in 1997, when South Korea was facing an economic crisis, the secret envoy Kim Ki-won was sent to the US to negotiate a bailout. And he said, this is really revealing, I didn't bother going to the IMF. I called the Treasury office from my home in Seoul, flew to Washington and went directly there. I knew that this is how it would get done. So the Treasury, the American Treasury, sent David Lipton, who was its most experienced veteran of emergency bailouts, to shadow the IMF negotiations with the government in Seoul. So in the immediate post-colonial era, the World Bank was headed by Robert McNamara, who had just before then been the US Secretary of Defense during the Vietnam War. In 1969, he declared that the World Bank is a body that makes investments whose objective is development. It is neither a philanthropic instrument nor a social welfare agency. So then, as the crisis of profitability raged across the global markets in the 1970s, there was a push to further pry open markets to pave the way for cheap investment. So the American state, the World Bank and the IMF were used as a battering ram against the economies of the global south, many of which contained very cheap labour and an abundance of natural resources. And this is the context, I think, in which aid in the neoliberal era needs to be understood. So by the mid-1970s and into the early 80s, there was a sharp drop in commodity prices, and many countries in the third world, desperate for funding, turned to the West for credit. So the Reagan administration in the US initially dismissed the IMF and the World Bank as Keynesian institutions that were a fetter to the principles of the free market and socialist cash cows for third world countries. He quickly, and his administration quickly changed their tunes after the Mexican banking crisis of 1982, when they realised that the IMF could be used to impose their neoliberal free market dogma across the third world. So credit was widely provided, but came with many political and economic strings attached. And I just want to spend a bit of time going through some of these. So the first consequence of the imposed neoliberal dogma was to bind the economic viability of poor nations to an export-led model. So this meant that countries would focus on a couple or often only one primary commodity that would be exported to rich countries, and then they would import finished goods for consumption. This blocked the ability for them to industrialise and diversify their underdeveloped economies and instead bound them in a straitjacket of single commodity production that left the economy extremely vulnerable to shifts in the global market. On the other hand, it provided very cheap inputs for multinationals whose access was also secured by the forced removal of trade regulations. So by the year 2000, primary commodity exports made up a whole 80% of African exports, compared to 31% for other countries in the developing world and 16% for advanced economies. This has also made these countries far more dependent on importing essential commodities such as food, destroying the livelihood of small agricultural producers and entrenching poverty. So people have been forced to go to the cities looking for work. When they get there, they are met with an extremely high unemployment rate, which again is often because jobs have been destroyed through the export-led model. Also explains the explosion of slums in the major cities across much of the developing world. So as a result of all of this, food consumption fell by 25% across the African continent from the 1960s through to the 1990s. There are a number of other conditions attached to foreign loans that amounted to the widespread imposition of austerity on the poor in the third world. So So in 1979, the US Federal Reserve massively hiked interest rates to a high of 20% in 1981, which had immediate reverberations right around the globe. For countries that were already indebted to international financial institutions, it meant a total inability to pay these loans. And on average, the new policy tripled the interest repayments on the same level of debt. So deals were done, which are called structural adjustment programs, to reschedule debt repayments involving enormous cuts to social spending, wide-scale privatisation of government-owned industries, the elimination of price subsidies and tariffs, corporate incentives like lower tax rates, and an attack on labour conditions and wages. So this has resulted in deep entrenchment of poverty right across the region. So the cuts to social programs have meant that not only are the foreign loans failing to meet the needs of the poor, but they are often actually reversing the basic indicators for quality of life. There's dozens of examples of this. I've just got a few here. So in Chile, IMF loan conditions cut wages by 40%. In Mexico, wages were cut in half over the 1980s, and spending on health and education was halved. Infant deaths due to malnutrition tripled over the same period. Also in the 1980s, across sub-Saharan Africa, in order to pay back debt, government funding for education was cut by 25% and health by 50%, and this is in the context of the AIDS crisis reaching epidemic proportions. So none of this actually resulted in increased growth across the African continent. The average rate of growth in Africa in the 70s was about 3.5%. By the late 1990s, it was at 2.2%. And at the same time, African debt was rising at the fastest rate of anywhere in the world. The IMF bizarrely declared it had resolved the debt crisis of the 1980s. In reality, it enmeshed the world's poorest countries into an endless debt trap, which most of these countries still exist in today. Low-income structural adjustment countries saw their international indebtedness more than quadruple over the 80s, with interest payments rising from $6.4 billion to $18.3 billion over the same time frame. So this period sacrificed the lives and health of millions of workers and peasants to the growth of international capital. More than 1 billion people were forced into the extremely miserable existence of living on less than $1 a day. Just want to talk really briefly about the role of the local ruling classes in all of this as well, who have for the most part been very complicit in overseeing structural adjustment programs and other such things, and very enthusiastic partners of global elites. So one example of this is the New Partnership for Africa's Development, NEPAD, which was created to provide more opportunities for the local African ruling class to be involved in trade policy. It's been championed by the presidents of South Africa and Nigeria, which are two local economic powerhouses, and acts as a local enforcer of IMF-style neoliberal trade and economic rules. Aid funds have also been used to enrich local ruling classes, with the cost then forced onto the poor of their countries through austerity. So this was the case with Mobutu, a Western ally, who was the former ruler of the Democratic Republic of Congo, which has been known as Zaire. So Zaire was one of the first recipients of a brutal structural adjustment program in the early 1980s. He decimated public institutions and the formal economy through privatisation, liberalisation and austerity. By the time he left power in 1997, the country held $12 billion in debt, which they could not pay, and reports to the IMF and the World Bank at the time exposed the extreme extent to which Mobutu had actually siphoned off money from the loans to contribute to his billions of dollars in personal wealth. Despite this, no debt relief was given to the country because the money had actually really been about making sure the leader kept his country aligned to the West. Instead, a new round of loans were offered to service the debt, further entrenching the indebtedness of the country. And this partly explains then the really brutal and deathly conflict that later broke out in that country. So while foreign aid provides some medical and social services, it's overwhelmingly failed to lift the global poor out of poverty, and as I've kind of explained, has actually kept them trapped in that cycle. Okay, so to start to conclude, I want to talk about what some alternative answers to global poverty might be. I think with the context of imperialism and the debt cycle and so on that I've described so far, I think the simple demand to increase foreign aid budgets is really not a sufficient answer. I think there are progressive demands that can be placed on global rulers. We should demand the cancellation of all debt that's been incurred through tight aid and IMF programs. We can demand that aid should be donated with no economic and political strings attached, and that aid in this form should actually be massively increased by the West as a form of reparations for the social, economic, political and ecological disasters that have been imposed on the third world. But I think more than this, we have to recognise that whole swathes of the world exist in poverty today because of the history of colonialism, the role of global imperialism today, and the self-interest of rulers in the third world. So requesting benevolence from rulers who stay rich because the poor remain poor is a strategy that won't get too far. I think instead we should support movements of the oppressed where they arise, movements which can start to challenge the economic deadlock that billions exist in globally. I've actually got one very recent, very concrete example of this happening. So just last month, 12 days of mass protests led by Ricky Martin culminated in a general strike that brought down the governor of Puerto Rico. So that was a country which had been strangled by IMF and dodgy aid programs. So the very deeply indebted territory was offered debt relief in 2015 on the condition of stringent austerity, which included shutting down schools and lowering the minimum wage. Then to add to this, most of the humanitarian aid that was allocated to Puerto Rico to deal with the devastation caused by Hurricane Maria in 2017 has not been seen by people on the ground. So a $300 million contract was given to a Montana-based company that had two employees to try repair the collapsed electrical system. This actually caused the second longest blackout in world history. Actually, more than 9 months after the hurricane, there were still people in Puerto Rico that could not turn their lights on. So when emails between the governor and his advisors were leaked that exposed pretty rank bigotry and also a deep disdain for the victims of the hurricane, the whole island launched into struggle. And this struggle included demands about the debt trap that they were in, and also the economic mismanagement of the area. So the governor's gone. The demands might not have been fully met at this stage, but I think this kind of movement is the sort of thing which points the way forward to us. And I'll leave it there. Firstly, I don't want to come across as kind of callous to people who think that foreign aid is a good thing and government should give more money to poor countries and so on, because there's a big element of truth to that, and we're kind of raised with pictures of starving children in Africa and black babies with AIDS and stuff like this, and it's presented to us as just this social crisis for which it's somewhat totally unexplainable, something about the background of Africa maybe, and that there needs to be a way of helping these people, and then the only kind of answer to that we're given is foreign aid budgets, charities, NGOs, etc. So I think it often comes from a good place that people think, yeah, the kind of wealthier West should actually be doing stuff to economically support and socially support people who are living in abject poverty. Just the problem is that when you actually dig into the whole structures that surround the setup of how all of that money is administered, it's actually just not helping people. And often it's doing really awful stuff to communities. So all the stuff I went through about imperialism and debt and austerity, but then also on a local level, often communities are destroyed by these things. Children are abused by aid workers and all this stuff. So it's just it's actually just not a sufficient answer to dealing with poverty in the global South, which actually is a very important, urgent question that everyone in the West should care about. Which kind of leads on to the two questions, which I thought were both really good questions. The first one, with the kind of NGO kind of model, like I think you can think of things that you could demand as a way to administer money and forms of aid to poor countries. I think things like, you know, government bodies that are heavily regulated and totally transparent that just go into local communities, where there's local structures of communities, not local NGOs, but communities, and the money and the resources are given to them and it's overseen by transparent government agencies. I think that, like, that would be a fine thing to do. But I think it's kind of utopian in a way. And with the NGOs, it's like, because I think you're right, it's like whether they're multinational or local, it's like the whole structure of it from top to bottom is pretty bankrupt. Like, I always think of House of Cards. People have seen House of Cards. And the woman, which I've just forgotten her name, she starts the series as the head of an NGO that just seems exactly like the one I spoke about, Bywater in Tanzania. It's some water NGO that's meant to be providing water to poor countries, et cetera, et cetera. But the show just shows that she's in, like, cahoots with corrupt local officials and local business magnates, and she does deals with them to help her political career that screw over the people of the local population. And she's actually just a CEO. You know, they're not philanthropists who are kind of, you know, giving up their life to try help their poor. The people who run the NGO structures are like corporate structures, and the people who run them are often very, very, very wealthy. Then there's some, in the lower ranks of the NGOs, I think it's kind of mixed. Like, I think a lot of people go into it because what I started with, they want to go and help the poor. And I think it's quite admirable in a way that there's all these people who think, I want to dedicate my life to trying to do some good work somewhere in the world. But these people often are horrified by what they're met with on the ground. And if you Google it, you can just read all of these exposés of NGO workers who are like, I signed up to this thing and then I went to this country in Africa and I saw this abuse and no money reaching anyone, and we said we had $20 million to administer, but then there was nothing on the ground. So there's that side of it. And then some of them actually are just awful, like the pedophilia rings that was uncovered a few years ago and stuff like that, because, like I said, they're above the law. So it's like the Catholic Church in a way. Like, it's a haven to go to if you want to act in hideous ways towards people but are very unlikely to be held to account. So I think when you take that is the kind of structure of it, there's no way to kind of tinker with that or fix that, because it's endemic. Like, it's all around the world in all of these different NGOs. So that's why I think, like, the thing that I said earlier about government agencies, etc., is something that I think would be a reasonable demand. But it would actually take the whole restructuring of the social order, I think, to have something like that, which is what I kind of finished with but didn't explain in great detail. It's like, the way that money travels around the world is not based on who is poor and who needs it, and people who are very, very rich are not spending their days thinking, how do I help people that are not as rich as me? Like, the third world is not poor because of a crisis of resources or, like, that there's not enough goods and services in the world to kind of help people, and that, you know, we have it here because they don't have it there and stuff like that. There is, which people probably heard at this conference, like an abundance of food, housing, you know, ways to facilitate clean drinking water, etc. So it's not a problem of resources, it's a problem of distribution. So I think that whole kind of logic of, well, where do resources go? Who gets to decide what goes where? Who can have, who doesn't have? That whole logic needs to be challenged to actually re-administer things around the world in a way that is socially just, which is why I think it comes back again to the social order. We should put progressive demands on the government and stuff like that. We should call out Trump and Johnson and people when they say, fuck poor people in the third world, why would we care about them? We're keeping the money for ourselves. That's not the answer. And then the volunteerism thing, I think, it's all kind of similar to that. It's like they are like smaller versions of NGOs. I'm not sure if they actually get foreign aid money. I'd have to, like, look that up. I didn't come across that when I was researching this. But it's the same kind of idea. It's like someone has a good business idea, which is to get kind of, you're right, like often white private school kids from the West to go and feel good building a little village or something for a while, and they make money off it. They make a lot of money off it. And you read stuff like often the houses that these people build or the little schoolrooms that they'd be built then get
pulled down as soon as they leave because they're shit and don't actually, like, perform the function that they're supposed to do. And then the local communities have to rebuild it, but then all those resources have been wasted. That small amount of money that lands in the community for a short period of time is gone and is useless. So I think it is, like, it does tie into the exact same kind of logic. And then it's true that often there is this whole kind of, like, white saviour kind of complex to it as well, which I think's pretty gross. But yeah, and that's why I like, because I spoke about the stuff in Puerto Rico. There's also stuff in the West. It's like there's a history of the organised workers in the West actually supporting liberation movements and struggles for independence and struggles for, like, human rights in the third world. Like in Australia, dock workers have gone on strike to support independence movements in Indonesia. It's the same thing with the fight against apartheid. Workers right across, organised workers right across the Western world organised themselves so that goods could not be travelled from their country to apartheid South Africa. So I think that much more lends in the kind of direction that actually provides not kind of band-aid solutions to poverty in the third world, but actually starting to rethink the whole kind of social order that keeps them poor.